So I'm grateful for the invitation, although most people are not grateful after hearing me speak. I'm still grateful for the invitation, and my topic was CGD and the gut, CGD and bowel disease. So I'm not going to really address liver disease at all. And the first thing to say, and I'm going to make this a theme through the talk, is that the bowel disease we see in CGD is inflammatory bowel disease, but it's not Crohn's and it's not ulcerative colitis. It's a different entity. So I have several biases, gastroenterology and coffee being the two main ones. And I was hesitating whether to put gastroenterology up there, and I'm not a pediatrician. And there are a number of reasons for that. I'm scared of the parents. And also, children ask too many honest questions. So I walked into, and I'll tell you why I'm hesitating to say gastroenterology. I walked into a patient's room last week, and the patient's mother said to the child, who was about 10, "This is a gastroenterologist." And the child said, "What does he do?" "Well, he's here to talk to you about colonoscopy." "What's that?" So she started to explain to him. And then he looked at me and he said, "How big is that tube?" And I said, "It's about 6 feet." I should have kept my mouth shut. So then he said, "Do they pay you for this?" I said, "Yes, tax dollars." And then it got worse because he asked me if I enjoy my job. So how do you answer that? Either way, you lose, right? If you enjoy it, you're bad. And if you don't, well, then I don't want you to see me. So I have no real biases. I try and see everything equally. I like zebras a lot. I spend my life looking at zebras, and I don't want to see the horses. I'm far more interested in the zebras. I think they're deserving of attention. And I have no conflicts other than that. But I am your tax dollars, as I said. So what I want to try and do, and Sergio told me I have 40 minutes, Steve told me I have 20 minutes, so I split the difference, I'm going to speak for 60 minutes. And I'm going to try and understand how CGD affects the gut, and I'm going to talk to you about that. And it's a very conceptual and clinical approach. Despite Sergio asking me to be molecular, I'm going to stick to the clinical. This is where I live. This is my home. It's where the rest of us live as well. It's the NIH Clinical Center, and this is the hospital. My room is somewhere here, Dr. Holland here. Sergio is in the basement. But that's where we live. And in case you're wondering about federal employees and whether we work a full day, I took this picture of a sunset to show you that some days I do stay there late. It was in the winter, but Bethesda can be beautiful too, not just New Orleans. So let's go through some basics. And again, feel free to interrupt. What Sergio said, you can ask your questions during the talk, and if there's things you want to know about, stop me. So we should talk about what the gut does, right? We should just revise that. It's essential for life. The first thing that we all think about, Dr. Holland said, he's thinking about dinner, not the lottery, right? Pleasure of eating. But we need it for energy and nutrients. It's really important. You asked the question about growth hormone, inflammatory bowel disease. That's really a big deal. That sort of inflammation and malabsorption and damage to the gut really affects growth. The gut's also really important in immune regulation. So I'm not saying that the people with bowel disease have different types of infections, but it really is very important for all sorts of things related to the immune system. And the other thing the gut's responsible for is quiet time. It's an excuse to get some quiet time behind a closed door. I just want to stop. This is really very beautiful. I just want to pause here and appreciate the beauty that the gut is. And let's just go through it for a second. So esophagus, food spends about 30 seconds in the esophagus. Once you've chewed it, it goes through. Stomach, 90 minutes. Maybe if you ate cabbage, 3-4 hours. But very fast. And then the small intestine, anyone guess? Sorry? No, 3 to 4 hours. Some people longer, but 3 to 4 hours. How much small intestine? We have 11 to 32 feet. It's very long. There are very few bacteria all along here. Very few bacteria. It's relatively sterile. Then we get to the colon. That's a different story. Not sterile at all. But we're meant to have bacteria in the colon. They're essential to health. And there's more and more evidence that this is really a crucial part of being a healthy person, having a diverse lot, group of bacteria inside your colon. And if you think about it, we're designed that way. There's a reason the appendix is hanging off the end of the colon here where the small bowel comes in. It's to keep the bacteria from getting into the small intestine. And there's a lot of immune tissue here. It's to keep the bacteria out of the small intestine, like the tonsils do here with the mouth. So we were meant to have no bacteria in our colon. Our appendix would be hanging out our butts. It's not. Right? It's here. So the colon is about 5 to 6 feet long, full of bacteria. How long does food spend in the colon? 36 to 72 hours. Very long. Right. So we said we eat to absorb the food, right, and the energy, but that happens here. So what's happening over here? Why are we keeping the food in the colon for so long? It would be easy to make a small pouch, keep it in the colon for an hour or two, store it until you can get to a bathroom, and then poop it out. Right? Why does it have to be there for so long? It's because we're feeding those bacteria. It's because we depend on those bacteria. It's in there for a reason. Those bacteria are extracting nutrients. They control growth and energy metabolism. They give us things like folate, vitamins, micronutrients. They're really important. But what's the problem if you have an immune system that's not perfect? This is full of bacteria. That's, if your immune system's not great, that may not be a good thing. So what's really interesting is that now we think of all inflammatory bowel disease as being kind of an immune defect. And we think of all inflammatory bowel disease as being difficulty in either sensing the bacteria or handling the bacteria. So we stop for a second. So if I can see my son coming and he's got that look on his face, I can head him off before he gets to my wife. I can prevent the explosion, right? She doesn't need to know what he just brought. But if there's difficulty sensing and he gets through, there's an explosion. Not my wife. My wife's wonderful. But let's say a different wife. If she was overreactive or if I was overreactive, there would be a different problem. There would be handling, inability to cope or handle. So sensing or handling the bacteria turns out to be a problem in all inflammatory bowel disease. And I'm just going to say this here because it's really interesting. The severity of the CGD doesn't seem to be related to whether you get inflammatory bowel disease or not in CGD. So that's also interesting. We can come back to that. Any questions? Okay. So for this system to work, there are a couple of things that are really important. First of all, you need to get food. If you don't put food in it, it doesn't work, right? And so the reason we have a brain and the reason we have arms and legs is to feed our gut. No other reason. Once it gets in there, it's got to move through. We spoke about how long it spends in different places, and it's got to keep moving. It's got to keep moving, otherwise it won't get to the next place. You've got to digest the food. That means break it down. You've got to absorb it, get it into the system, and then you've got to eliminate waste. So these are the essential functions, and we're going to sort of see how that ties in to CGD. Oops. So what can go wrong? Well, please don't tell anyone I said this in public, and this is where you should not record, but the gut is kind of dumb. It can only react in certain ways. It's got limited responses. So you guys are very sophisticated. You can come back with a clever answer to whatever insult you're given. The gut can't do that. The gut usually has very few options. Mostly pain. If it's in the upper intestine, there's nausea and vomiting. If it's in the lower intestine, there's diarrhea and constipation. And anywhere along the way, if there's a problem, you can get bleeding. That's it. Not very complicated. So easy to understand. So we use those symptoms and we use the way the patient tells you about the symptoms to understand where the problem is. So if someone tells you, I'm having 15 or 20 bowel movements a day, that's only the colon. Can be nowhere else. They say I'm having one or two very large watery diarrheal stools a day, mostly small bowel, not always. So we can use the clues. That's why we ask you all those questions. First of all, I like poop, and I like talking about poop, which is why I ask you the questions. But the other reason I ask you about the questions is because it tells me where I'm going to put that tube. And it tells me what to look for and where I'm going to look. Does that make sense? So it's not just, let me ask you about your poop. An amazing 40% of CGD patients in our cohort at that age, again, get inflammatory bowel disease. Some form or another. And it goes from very mild to severe. Very severe is rare, but some sort of spectrum of the inflammatory bowel disease, 40%. That's a lot. So this is common in CGD. What about, so now we're talking about CGD, not in general. The commonest things we see are diarrhea. Inflammatory markers go up. Dr. Holland mentioned the ESR and the CRP. Those are blood tests for inflammation. We often see anemia, and with anemia, we often see growth retardation, which you asked about. And what's really interesting is you almost never see patients complain of significant pain. So that's very different to Crohn's. Every Crohn's patient knows and loves narcotics. Every ulcerative colitis patient has a hotline, a speed dial to get their narcotics on refill to the pharmacy. CGD, we don't see pain at all. It's very unusual. There are some patients, but it's not typical. So that's interesting, I think. Very different. And just to go through the things that we see in CGD, and I divide it into two groups. The first is related to movement, and the second related to inflammation. So in CGD, problems related to movement, okay, the way things move through the bowel, remember it has to move through to function. So the first problem is some people have swallowing difficulty, and the food gets stuck, and doesn't go down, they have to wash it down, and that can be because the muscle doesn't move or because they develop narrowings or strictures, but mostly because the muscle doesn't move properly. They can develop nausea and vomiting because of the outlet obstruction, like Sergio pointed, showed you, but also because the stomach muscle doesn't work. The stomach becomes floppy, sits there, says, I'm sick of this. I'm not going to work today. And it doesn't contract like it should. So the food sits there, you feel nauseous, you feel full, you vomit. Not common, but it does happen. And constipation. Constipation is a big thing. So let's say you're going to have a bowel movement once a week. Not good, right? But let's say that was the case, because you have CGD and your colon doesn't really squeeze like it should. But you add inflammatory bowel disease to that, and instead you have a bowel movement every day. So you're very happy. You say, I don't have diarrhea, I don't have constipation. But that fools me, because I think you're normal, but meanwhile you're having more bowel movements, seven times more bowel movements than you would have had, because constipation is such a feature, even inflammatory bowel disease in CGD. So for us, as gastroenterologists, one of the most confusing things when I started seeing patients with CGD was the lack of real diarrhea. We do see it, but not as commonly as you would expect. Inflammation presents in a number of ways. Ulcers, and I'm going to show you some nice pictures, or I think they're nice. I hope none of you recognize yourselves. Fistulae, which is a connection, like Sergio showed you, between two things that shouldn't be connected. And I'm going to show you a picture of that. Abscess formation, I'm going to show you something that's a collection of pus in the liver. I'm going to show you somewhere else. And strictures are, as a result of inflammation, people get narrowing. Okay? So these are the cardinal features of bowel disease in CGD. So this is the esophagus in a patient. And I don't know if it projects well. Or the lights are... So the esophagus is a beautiful tube. It's straight, smooth. It's got this pearly sort of translucence to it. It's very pretty. And you can see this is a normal-looking esophagus except for these ulcers. These are ulcers going down the esophagus in lines, in rows, marching down. And this white on the ulcer is pus. And this is not an infection. This responds to anti-inflammatory treatment. So you can see disease in the esophagus, but not so common. This is another, just to go back to the movement. When the esophagus contracts, it's beautiful. It's like a wave. When you're sitting in there with an endoscope and you watch, you see the wave move through. In CGD, you don't often see that. And what you can see here is that the rings, do you see these sort of rings going down? Do you all see the rings? Okay. These are little parts of the esophagus just contracting at the same time. How's food going to get through if everything's just squeezing at the same time? The other thing that's abnormal, it's not a nice circle. Do you see sort of a funny shape? And it can even look like a keyhole. So the movement and the muscle often isn't normal either. The stomach often isn't. In about 75% of people who've got colonic involvement, we see stomach involvement, but it's very mild in terms of the inflammatory bowel disease type picture. And what we typically see is a small linear ulcer like that. You see the raised area here? And over there in the middle, there's a little cleft ulcer. What's also interesting is, do you see the stippling? Normally you don't see the stippling, but that's because the stomach is edematous or swollen, and so all the pits in the stomach become pronounced and easy to see. Now we get to my favorite organ, the colon. Well, second favorite, actually the liver, but for the moment. So this is a pretty nice looking colon, good looking, pretty beautiful. You see the vessels coming through. This is bits of bile and mucus. It's normal. But you see these little white ulcers? They're like cold sores. This is the first stage of colitis. This is what we see most often in people with very mild or early disease. Little abscess ulcers. Those patients often don't have symptoms, but they might be anemic, they might have growth retardation, and they might have elevated inflammatory markers. Usually they don't have GI symptoms. So you have to suspect it to look for it. And I'm going to walk you down the ladder of severity. And when people see this, and I tell them they're mild, they say, why should we be treated? When I see this, I say, it's early yet. And what we're trying to prevent is where we're going, where I'm going to take you. So this is a little bit more advanced. So do you see the vessels are dilated? Before we saw a few vessels, now there are lots of them. It's because it's inflamed. The vessels are all dilated, bringing those immune cells, which I know nothing about, into the territory. See the ulcers, this redness, this patchy redness. There aren't any real ulcers, but there's lots of patchy redness, and the abscess ulcers and the vessels are all excited. And the mucus is different. The mucus is more sticky, right? Not as smooth. It's dried out. So you look in that, you say, oh, this is someone who's progressing. Then it goes to the next stage. So you see this is the ulcer here, and it's surrounded by redness and swelling. And if you look at, you can't really, I mean, you have to take my word for it, but there's no nice vessels in the rest of it. Now the vessels are going away. This is a longer-term disease. And this is where patients can end up. All of this yellow here is an ulcer. Do you see this? Right? This is one huge ulcer. And this area around it, this is red and inflamed. There are no vessels. It's swollen. The lining is stripped off. This is more severe. These patients have diarrhea. And these ulcers are very deep. This is what Crohn's disease looks like, which is why people often think CGD, inflammatory bowel disease, is Crohn's disease. But it's not. I'm going to tell you why. So any questions so far? No? Okay, and I just wanted to show one picture because I think it's very telling. This is a granuloma, sort of the edge of it. But all these blue dots are inflammatory cells. This is the colon. And the colon is normally very neat and ordered. It's very meticulous. You don't think of it as being meticulous. I'm sure you don't. You think of it as being poopy. But it's not. It's very, very structured and symmetrical. And there are these beautiful rows of glands. They make the mucus and all sorts of other things. You can see this guy used to be one of these. And you can see these guys here are being destroyed by the inflammation. And this guy's about to be sloughed off. Here's a little bit of the lining that's left. But the lining, the nice, normal, smooth lining is completely gone. So we take biopsies because the biopsies are helpful for us. They tell us, allow us to assess the severity in a different way. Because if you look at this patient, that biopsy that I just showed you might have come from here. So it again gives you a sense of the severity. Okay, what about abscess? I'm going to show you just one picture. I'm sorry, it doesn't project. You have to take my word for it. This is a man. Let me see. Okay. Thank you. So this is a man lying on his back. Here's one hip. Here's another hip. This is an MRI. Here's the base of his prostate. Here's his rectum. And you see there's this white thing here filled with fluid and air. that sort of snuck into a particularly private spot right next to the prostate should not be there. That's a collection of pus. Right? So abscesses form not just in the liver, but in this area around the rectum and anus, in the buttocks, next to the prostate, next to the bladder, around the uterus and vagina, very commonly. No, it's rare. So don't get worried. What about fistulae? So this is another MRI. Here's the liver coming down. This is the stomach. Here's the colon. There's a little bit of small bowel. And you see there's this abnormal connection between the colon and the stomach. How do you think that guy's breath smelled? The colon is high pressure areas of the gas. The stomach is used to collapsing. So the gas goes this way to the stomach. Burping wasn't a pleasurable experience for him. So that's a fistula. That's an example of a fistula. Also rare, fortunately, but we in a tertiary center, Dr. Holland has a way of finding them, and like he dragged me into pediatrics, he drags these patients in. What about the anus? And this is a particularly instructive case. Here is a very ulcerated anus, and if you can imagine, this was a flap of tissue that you could do this to. So she actually was a gymnast and hadn't really told anyone about this. We treated her and she healed very beautifully. This is normal anus, in case you're wondering. And then she developed a complication in the treatment, which I'm going to come back to. So we had to stop the medicines. Look what happened when we stopped the medicines. And you can, this is a better picture, and you can get a sense of the flap. Those are my fingers. Nice fingers, right? And it looks terrible. But again, with treatment, she cleared up, and she actually had a bone marrow transplant and has done fantastically well. And one of the important things about bone marrow transplant is that the bowel disease generally goes away. So that's also rare, in case you're worrying. Let's talk about location for a minute. So why it's like Crohn's is because they get these ulcers. Patients get ulcers that skip and have so-called normal-looking areas in between. But why it's not like Crohn's is that if there's disease, the rectum is almost always involved, 90%. And in fact, those people we've done, this is our endoscopy at the NIH, about 150 endoscopies. In my experience, in those patients where the rectum is not involved, they're already on treatment. When we get patients who haven't been treated, the rectum's always involved. So this is the progression. If this is involved, the end of the small bowel, for sure the rest is involved. You can have rectal disease only, but if you've got disease on the other side, remember my initial beautiful picture? If you've got disease on the other side, for sure you have rectal disease. So like ulcerative colitis, it starts on this end of the bowel in the rectum, and it moves across. It doesn't really move, but in terms of how we think about it. So the distribution is like ulcerative colitis. But the ulcers and the way they look is more like Crohn's. Does this figure make sense? Okay. So let's talk about treatment. And I'm keeping this very simple, and I did not mention bone marrow transplant because I know it's going to be addressed. We use medicines, and we approach it in a stepwise way. We want to define, when we get a new patient, the first question we ask is, what part of the bowel is involved? Because if it's just the anus and rectum, we don't have to give you toxic medicines to swallow. We can just give you suppositories or enemas, and we don't have to get the side effects. If it's involving the whole bowel, or most of the bowel, upper bowel too, then we have to give you systemic therapy. If it's mild, we don't have to give you very toxic medicines, even if it involves the whole bowel. We can start with medicines that are less toxic. But if it's severe throughout, we have to go to the more toxic medicines. So what I'm saying is we try to be appropriate for the geography, for where the disease is, and for the severity of the disease. So patients come in and they say, where are you going to put that 6-foot thing? And like all of you are clenching right now, that's what they're doing, and they're moving to the other end of the bed. That's why we do it, because we don't want to give you medicines you don't need. And we don't want to give you toxicities that you don't need. We want to be sure that you need that medicine. So we want to understand where the disease is and how bad it is. And remember, the disease involves immunosuppression. So if you get too exuberant, and if you get intoxicated by your own exuberance, and you give medicines that are too immunosuppressive, patients will get infections. And we've had experience with that, where we've done damage to patients by immunosuppressing them too much. The patient I showed you with the anus, we gave her pneumonia to put her in the intensive care unit. We fixed her anus, but we nearly killed her. Right? I'd rather have an anus that's not well. So we've learned lessons along the way, thanks to patients coming to us and humbling us and teaching us how often we're wrong. And I think now we understand sort of the levels, that how far we can push and how far we cannot push. But that doesn't mean we can always fix things. And sometimes we're stuck. And then we go to surgery. If not bone marrow transplant, we go to surgery. And surgery is very useful because you can divert the stool away from the colon. You can bring the small bowel out here, and people wear a bag. It's called an ostomy. And the bowel disease gets much better, but doesn't go away. You can drain the abscesses like the one I showed you. And if all else fails, you can actually cut out the whole colon. It's called a complete proctocolectomy. And you can also do what's called an APR, abdominal peroneal resection, where you remove the anus as well. And we have a couple of patients who've gone to that. And 2 weeks ago, I saw one of the patients who I hadn't seen since 2006. I'd seen him almost every month. Last time I saw him was 2006 after that surgery. And he said to me he doesn't know why he resisted that surgery for so long. His life has been normal for the first time in the last 10 years. So when we talk about surgeries like that, parents and people often look at us and say, whoa. But sometimes, at the moment, given our current therapies and our current limitations, that's what we're stuck with. And we would never recommend that lightly. But again, that's rare. Okay, so the future. Cure is beyond the scope of what I do. I just like to play with toys. And we can learn from other inflammatory bowel diseases. We can learn a lot from other inflammatory bowel diseases and how they're treated. And we've tried very hard to keep track as the field has progressed. There's more risk in CGD, as we've said. People are already immunosuppressed, and we're adding to that immunosuppression. There are unique approaches that we can take in CGD, and I think it's a wonderful time to be a mouse. We can cure so much in a mouse. We give them the disease, we cure the disease, but actually I don't care about mice. I care about people, and I care about the patients, and I want to see those therapies come to humans, and I want to see them work in humans. And that's hopefully where we're heading. And we should use the mouse as models, and I don't mean in Playboy, I mean of the disease. And we should use targeted approaches. And an example of that, something that I don't know is going to work but has become very significant in ulcerative colitis, is a drug that targets cells that respond to bacteria only in the gut. Right? So how does an inflammatory cell know to go to the gut and not to the nose? Right? How did the lymphocyte, the neutrophils sitting in my gut now, know that it should go to my gut and not to my nose? Or my sinus, or my ear, because they're flags, they're signals. They're called integrins that tell the bacteria, that tell the cells to go to the gut. And we're developing an understanding of those integrins, and we're developing ways to block them. So I want to thank the patients, and if only for the opportunity to thank patients for teaching me and humbling me, I'm grateful to be here speaking to you. I want to thank my fellows, my trainees who've worked with me over the past 2 years with the CGD patients. They're listed here, the pathologist and the surgeon, Dr. Cruzado and Dr. Hughes. And I especially want to thank the real deal. And that's the CGD team at the NIH, the people that I've worked with. I didn't put Vicky's name up there because I haven't really been torturing Vicky recently, but Vicky was very much part of the initial trouble. But everyone else I think that I've tormented is up there. And and also Sergio's not there because he's in the basement. But I particularly want to thank Dr. Holland for dragging me into this, kicking and screaming. I'm so grateful. It's been so rewarding and so exciting, and the opportunity to learn and grow and stretch and make a difference in people's lives is, as MasterCard says, priceless. I wanted to end with, I showed you a sunset picture to start. I wanted to end with a picture of the dawn, and because I think it's a new dawn. This is my youngest son. He woke up, and this is a place we go to on vacation. He woke up very early in the morning. You can see it's dawn, just breaking, and he went to fish. And he caught this tiny, tiny fish. Do you see it? I don't know if you can even see it. And he was so excited. He screamed, and he woke the whole neighborhood up. And I think if there were any frogs sleeping, he woke them up too. And the point is, we're just catching small fish. We're just at the beginning, right? This is the dawn of a different era. And as Dr. Holland showed you the progress, I'm hoping that we make the same progress and continue to make that progress with CGD GI disease. Thank you.